Apache Kafka is famously unconcerned about the type of the things you put in it. When you produce a message to a topic, it's just stored as raw bytes. Kafka doesn't care what's in there. Of course, you do, which is why Confluent made the Schema Registry. Schema Registry has recently become a standard feature in Confluent Cloud. So I invited lead developer Magesh Nandakumar to tell us all about it on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and in this case, Confluent Cloud. Welcome back, everybody. My guest today on Streaming Audio is Magesh Nandakumar. Magesh, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tim. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Now, Magesh and I are coworkers, but not all that closely. We don't work together too often. But what do you do here, Magesh?
I work as part of the engineering team. I primarily work on Schema Registry and Connect. So I've been working on Schema Registry when I started with Confluent, and then I transitioned into the Connect team and started doing Schema Registry, Connect, Connectors.
Nice, nice. So we've talked about Connect on the show before, and I'm trying to remember. My memory of this isn't very good. I don't think we've talked about Schema Registry directly before. I'm sure there will be somebody on the internet who tells me if I'm wrong, and we have, and that's good to get that kind of feedback. So nominally, what I want to talk to you about today is Schema Registry in Confluent Cloud. Now, as of the time of this recording, that's a relatively recent feature that Confluent Cloud has rolled out. By the time this goes live, it'll be only a few weeks less recent, but fairly new feature. But maybe let's just start by talking about Schema Registry itself, because Schema Registry being in the cloud is sort of a thing that we can say, and that subject is kind of done at that point. Yep, but we should talk through the Schema Registry itself. What is it? Imagine if somebody in the audience just didn't know it. They knew Kafka, but they didn't know Schema Registry. What's it all about?
Yep. That, I think, is a great start to get going. So if we look at actually Kafka doesn't really care what we send. The producers can just send anything, and the protocol itself is just caring about the bytes that's being sent. This makes Kafka really powerful, just because you can send any kind of data into it. And this also means that your architecture is completely decoupled, be it being your pipelines or be it your event-driven architecture. It's like completely decoupled architecture. But this also leads to few challenges. Let's say if you're a typical developer, you're building a REST API, you start with having an API interface, and you typically document it in Swagger or some kind of tool, and that's how we get going with it. Or let's say if you're building a backend system, you typically connect to a database and you have some kind of schemas that are defined against the database, and that's your contract. But when it comes to Kafka, since we are just dealing with bytes, there's no real contract here. So what really happens is, if there's a producer who is producing a data, the consumer would now need to understand what's in it to go process the data. So if they really have to do this, then there's only two options. They either have to infer it themselves or go talk to the producer and understand what the data structure is. This would mean that there's a lot of coupling between the teams, which is not really desirable in a big enterprise or even if you're a small company, because a decoupled architecture should also mean it's decoupled teams. That just doesn't mean that you cannot socialize. It just means that you don't want to coordinate over a schema every time there's a change to it.
That's a really good point. Decoupled doesn't mean that you don't like each other. It means that you don't absolutely have to talk in order to advance your separate projects. You get together, you have lunch, you enjoy each other's company, you send each other memes on Slack during the day. Yep. But when it comes time to actually make a commit, you don't have to ask permission.
Yep, absolutely. So schemas are generally a great way to solve this problem. So that's why something like Schema Registry is pretty useful. So what we recommend from Confluent is using the Confluent Schema Registry, use Avro as your data type. There are a couple of reasons why we recommend using Avro. First of all, Avro is like a binary format. It's not just text you're sending. That gives you a lot of saving when you send data over the wire. And Avro is also rich in terms of its schema definition and also its compatibility rules. So what essentially schema registry is doing is like it's a tool that helps you define what your schema is for the stream that you're creating. It can be a pipeline or like event-driven microservice, like I mentioned before. And the consumer would now just have to like talk to a schema registry to understand what the data is and process it. That's how schema registry solves this problem of tight coupling between the teams.
Gotcha. So at the code level, when I'm writing code, there's a schema registry out there. It's some piece of infrastructure that is running outside my brokers, right? It's a Kafka client. Mm-hmm. And I am writing code in some language to produce and consume to and from Kafka. Say it's Java. Now the producer and the consumer are going to be the ones talking to the schema registry sort of invisibly to me, right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So the way this happens is like Kafka in general, both producers and consumers have this notion of serializers and deserializers. So we ship what is known as an Avro serializer, which helps you talk to a schema registry. So every time a producer comes in, they produce a data, let's say, which is an Avro object, then the serializer magically talks to a schema registry, register the schema for you, and then it also serializes into a byte format, which Kafka understands, and sends the data. When the data is sent to the Kafka topic, the schema ID is encoded as part of the message that's being sent into Kafka. Now, the consumer would have to now, all they have to do is like configure the Avro deserializer, and they could just get the schema, the deserializer would now just get the schema ID out of the message, go talk to schema registry, get the schema, and then deserialize using the actual writer schema. So there's generally two kind of schemas when it comes to like schema processing and event streaming. There's a writer schema and a reader schema. You would want both the writer schema and reader schema in general to be compatible to each other just so that you don't break your downstream consumers.
Right. And I want to get back to compatibility in a minute. That sounds important. Mm-hmm. And also good, I like the terms that you've introduced, writer schema and reader schema, because if we're decoupled, and again, these applications, whatever application is write is producing to a topic and whatever applications are mm-hmm. consuming from the topic, because there may be many of those, they may evolve at different paces. They may have different release cycles. If they're event-driven microservices, I'll put that a bit more strongly, they had darn well better have different release cycles, you know, so that we can evolve them separately and not have to version all my microservices when I change one thing. You know, that's the worst in the world. So you do have different schemas that you're writing and you're reading.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Now, I always default to Java because it's me, but at the producer level, I remember the first time I saw schema registry code that was using schema registry, something was a little disquieting to me because it looked like there was magic. There's mm-hmm. a little config that you give the producer or the consumer telling it the URL of the schema registry's interface, the URL of the schema registry. And then you kind of don't do anything. You don't like register the schema. It just felt like there should be some API interaction. Like, dang it, I should have to pick up a bucket of Avro data and move it from there to here or something. It just felt like there should be code for that. And there really isn't. You just have an object in terms of your language. There'll be like a Java object.
Yep.
And you program in terms of that object, you change the state of it, you create one, you alter it, and then you produce it. And as you said, it gets serialized and written into the topic.
Yep. So when a developer comes in, like you mentioned, it's just an object. It's a simple POJO. If you want
well,
to go back.
Well, looks
to
like the, a POJO if you open the code.
Yeah.
There's nothing P about it, but.
Yep. So it looks more like a POJO. It's a generated class from a Avro schema, generally. And then the serializer does all the magic to extract the schema out of it and then go register the schema for you. So this is typically how you want to get started with schema registry. It's super simple. It's going to register the schema for you, and then you can get an application up and running in like a few minutes, actually, technically. If you just go to the docs.confluent.io, you'll see the code snippet there. You can just go paste it in your application, and you'll get started.
Yeah, that's such good advice. Just go to docs.confluent.io. I love that. Yeah. So true. But and I want to underscore another thing there is that you've got an Avro schema file, an AVSC file, which is a JSON format that is basically Avro's IDL, right? It's way of describing the interface of the type. And there's a step in the build process. In the case of Java, it would be a Maven or a Gradle plugin that turn that into this instrumented code that looks like a POJO.
Yes.
And so the answer, when I first saw the schema registry code, and I was upset because it looked like more should be happening, the answer is that more that is happening is in two places. One, it's in that generated code. And two, it's in the producer or the consumer itself, where it's configured. Well, I guess it's in the serializer is really where it is. Yep. There's the Confluent Avro serializer that is looking inside that object, getting the schema out of that generated object, because one of the things that gets generated into that object that's built from the AVSC file is a description of the schema itself.
Yep.
And all that just gets kind of pulled out of there, and the serializer communicates to the schema registry, and you know, magic happens. But the good news is, like, the, at least in my opinion, and I'll tell you this as, you know, you're a developer who works on this, I think the surface area that the developer sees there is actually kind of nice. It's it's a well-built API.
Yep. So just because that the fact that you brought in AVSC, I also wanted to add a few things there, actually, just for our audience here. So AVSC, like you mentioned, is like the schema definition. I often tend to compare that to DDLs in a traditional database world, if people want to have a comparison. And like I said, like the serializer automatically does all the magic and registers the schema for you. But there are also users who generally do not want to do such things in production. So there's a small bit of advice for them. So you could always auto-register your schemas in your dev environment and then get your schema registered against schema registry, get it working and all of that. After that, you could always take the AVSC file that you used in your development environment. And there's an amazing Maven plugin that we have to go register your schemas and manage the lifecycle of your schemas against schema registry. So you can set up your CI/CD pipeline to use that Maven plugin and then register your schemas for, like, say, staging or production. And then you can just turn off auto-register in your producer applications.
Nice. So that way, if somebody slips a change in and rebuilds the code and redeploys a service that's producing to a schema managed topic, then it doesn't doesn't just automatically work. You know, there's a little bit of discipline around schemas.
Yes. So you should just, I mean, it's not really essential, but then you could just turn off the auto register and then set up security around schema registry and really specify who can register schemas and who can read schemas and do all of that.
Nice. Yeah. So I think the default path is this extremely developer friendly, go ahead and migrate the schema. It's fine. Everything just works. Yep. But when more discipline than that is called for, you've got the option, which is good.
Yep.
It's always good to have it both ways. And it's good for the default to be the easy way, in my opinion. So I like the way that's set up.
Yep.
Let's talk about compatibility, because that's another thing. I mean, schema migration is always bad, right? It's bad in relational databases. It's never not a problem. And it's not like there's anything magical in Kafka that makes it automatic or anything, but schema registry helps with that. So you had mentioned that early on. You said you want to make sure that the reader schema is compatible with the writer schema so that, you know, when I'm getting data out of a topic, I have some guarantee that even if I'm of a different version, that things will work. So just kind of walk us through compatibility and schema registry.
Yeah, sure. So scheme, like I mentioned, like your consumers and producers would have to be compatible when you make a schema change. If I just want to walk through with a simple example, let's say you have a like address event that you are publishing as part of some changes in your application. And you want to, let's say, like change the format of how your zip code is being sent. So it could just be you are extending the number of characters that are allowed. That to me is a compatible change. Whereas if, let's say, if you have a timestamp column and if you want to change it from time in milliseconds to like a completely different time format, that to me is not a compatible change because it could potentially break your consumers. So what we really offer here in Schema Registry is like different kind of compatibility modes. We have something called as backward compatible mode, which would mean that like your consumer would have to be upgraded before your producer. And there are also other compatibility modes like forward compatibility and full compatibility mode. So the default is backward compatibility, but for a real good architecture where you want disparate schemas between multiple producers and multiple consumers producing it to the same topic, the recommended approach, in my opinion, should be like the full compatibility, even though it's a lot stricter. It would provide you a better decoupling because you really cannot assume that there's always only one producer and one consumer. So you could actually set these compatibility levels at what we call as subjects in Schema Registry. So subjects are nothing but a logical container to evolve your schemas. So basically, within a given subject, you could have a schema registered, and that schema corresponds to a topic. And the subject, it's the subject actually that corresponds to a topic. And when you have changes to your schema, you register a new schema against the subject. And that's the first thing that we do is like go check if the new schema is compatible with the latest schema by default. And then if it's not compatible, you're not going to be able to register the schema and like you're stopped right there. If it is compatible, then the schema gets registered as a newer version of the schema that's created. That doesn't mean that all the producer applications would have to continue, would have to like start using the new schema to produce data. That could still be producer applications, which are like using the older schema. This is very, very common, especially when you're doing a zero downtime release in production. You could have instances of your producer application, which is still producing data using the older schema. You could bring up newer instances of your application or service that's using the newer schema. So your topic now contains data with both old schema and new schema. So even if you do not have multiple producers, there's a situation where you would have like data with both the schemas and where the writer schema is different. Now, since we are pinning the schema ID with the message itself, the consumers should be able to get the writer schema from it. And they will be able to, like, they have their reader schema. They should be able to deserialize using that schema. If they have to be able to do that successfully, then the schema should have been compatible. Of course, there's an option to set a non-compatibility in Schema Registry, but I would almost recommend not setting it at all. There are certain scenarios where you might want to do a non-compatibility, like when you're like migrating from one schema type to another, or if you have a breaking change. Even in those cases, I generally recommend using a new topic than setting a non-compatibility.
Right. Indeed, for big and breaking migrations, a new topic is always a good thing. But
yep.
But we have, you made a bunch of good points in there, like zero downtime deploys, you're always going to have two producer instances at some point.
Yep.
That's just how it works. Even if your producer is a single application and it doesn't need to scale out beyond an instance, you're still going to do that when you deploy new versions, if you do zero downtime deploys. And in general, with decoupled readers and writers, which is very important, And not everybody is going to be on the same version. It's just how it has to be.
Yep.
Now, to clarify one thing, the compatibility support in schema registry is really compatibility checking. I mean, it doesn't do anything to migrate message formats, right? It's just telling you, you may register this because it's forward compatible, or it's backward compatible, or it's fully compatible, or you may not, based on how you've configured the compatibility for that subject, right?
Yeah, that's perfect. Yep.
And a subject is basically like a topic value or topic key, right? Is that correct?
That's a default subject to topic mapping. Yep.
Okay.
There are other options available, but most users just use this.
Ah, what are the other options? There's one of the great things about doing this podcast is sometimes I learn things, and I, ladies and gentlemen, I'm about to learn something about schema registry, and I know many of you are too. So, yeah, I honestly thought subjects were just like the pairing of topic and key or topic and value.
Yep. So we have something called as a subject name strategy. This is something that you could configure on your producer and your consumer. The only downside of using a subject name strategy is that like all your applications would have to use the exact subject name strategy. But then the subject name strategy itself is a configurable thing. If you want to evolve, let's say, a user schema, and there are different applications or services producing to different topics using this user schema, but you still, from a data governance standpoint, you still want to evolve the user schema under one subject, then there's a way to do that. The way you do that is we have something called as a record name strategy. Basically, it takes the Avro record name as your subject name. And you would have to just configure your producer application to use the record name strategy. And your consumer application should also use the same record name strategy. Can this be standardized across the enterprise? Yes, there can be some standardization that can happen. And currently, we do not enforce this anywhere. But yeah, it'll be good to enforce it somewhere. You could also plug in your own subject name strategy. Let's say if you want to hold a mapping between your topic and subject in some kind of registry of your own, and you could do that, and your subject name strategy can then resolve the subject name based on that registry or whatever, and then provide the topic to subject mapping.
Okay. So that's pluggable. That's good to know. But the conventionally, subject means subject would just mean topic. But the reality is that there are two things that go into topics, which can have schemas, and those are keys and values.
Yeah, and it's not necessary you have a schema for both key and value. Sometimes key could just be a string or an integer.
Right. I think frequently key. I don't want to say about frequently. I know people do it a lot of ways, but. It's not at all unusual for key to just be a primitive data type like a string or a number, and you don't manage schemas for those because those schemas don't change.
Yep.
However, string is also a little bit of a trap. Just knowing that you can schema manage keys, sometimes strings get interesting, right?
Yeah, but I've also seen a lot of users, even for their primitives, they prefer to use Avro, and they use schema registry for it just so that no one changes the key type. And that's compatible as well.
Ah, there you go. Okay, so you have set compatibility and determined nobody can just go producing a new type there. That's nice.
Especially if it's let's say if it's a double, and tomorrow you don't want somebody to change that schema type to integer.
Right. That makes sense. So to stress again, when you're migrating schemas, I started this question by saying, really acknowledging that, look, schema migration is kind of bad anywhere. It's always a little bit of a pain. And so when you need to change a schema, you gave the example of, say, going from 6 digits to 10 digits on zip code. And even zip code is a little bit of a It's not exactly a localized concept, but suppose, you know, your addresses were all US addresses and you had been six yep. digits and you want to go to 10 or characters. That's a schema migration. You do have to ensure that the actual code that reads values, zip code values out of consumed messages in the new version of the code, you know, you need to make sure that that code doesn't freak out when it sees six digit zip codes.
Yep. And as a producer, you don't want to be testing all of that.
Yeah, right.
You want to know right away if it's compatible or not.
Exactly. You don't want to put that on the producer, but there isn't, you still have a responsibility to attend to schema changes and attend to compatibility.
Yep.
But you get to now define, say, the values in the messages that go in this topic, the schemas must always be forward compatible. Mm-hmm. And you set that in the subject. And anytime you try to register a new schema, whether that's auto register because somebody changed the Avro file and rebuilt the code and redeployed it, and it auto registered the new schema, or it was an intentional deployment process, automated deployment process that registered the new schema. Mm-hmm. If you create a new schema that's not going to be forward compatible, you know, then it fails before you produce offending data.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's the key thing. It's you still at the consumer level, you still have to manage the fact that things might look different in your code. And that could mean conditionals and all the things that we don't like writing. But you get a guarantee now that based on the compatibility rules you have decided on for that value in that topic, you're not going to produce messages that violate those compatibility rules.
Yep.
I like that. Here's a question I get a lot. And I feel like I never have an adequate answer just because I wasn't there at the time, but why mm-hmm. Avro and not, you know, fill in the blank?
That's a great question. I get questioned about it quite a bit too. There's a lot of just to go back with history, I mean, schema registry existed before I started here, but then just from talking to people and getting some tribal knowledge out of people here, the key reason is like Avro by default has this notion of compatibility. Avro is very rich in terms of how it defines its compatibility rules. And it's very natural for people to use something like that. But there are also other users who have been using JSON and protobuf recently. People prefer protobuf because it's very simple and it's very easy to use. And it also has rich cross-language and cross-platform support. So we have been looking at options to add support for other types. I just cannot promise when it's going to come, but we are actively looking at it. I've actually spoken to a few people in the community about adding support for protobuf and what they think that should be. So if you're a user and if you think you want support for either JSON or protobuf, and if you have thoughts on how that compatibility rule should be defined, just send us a note. You could even post a note in some GitHub issue, and then we can collaborate there, actually.
Nice. I like that a lot. So that GitHub repo, I'm going to make sure that GitHub repo is in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a great thing to do. If you've got thoughts on how that should work, please contribute, even just by discussing an issue, even if you don't want to contribute code. But that's good to hear that is, you know, potentially a future thing. Like I said, we don't talk about release dates here on this show. And if we did, it wouldn't be you and me talking about them.
Yep.
But it's at least being contemplated, mm-hmm. and it could be a future thing.
Yep.
We all know that's the kind of thing that everybody is never going to be happy, because protobuf is certainly the one I get asked about the most,
mm-hmm.
But there will be some other serialization format that still isn't included yet. And it's always going to be an opinionated thing.
Yep. Yep.
Where there will be some subset of serialization formats that are supported because, you know, we have to do other things besides new serialization formats like pick up clothes from the cleaners,
mm-hmm.
and deploy schema registry in Confluent Cloud also, yep. which is a segue.
Mm-hmm.
This, by the way, my gosh, this has been a great overview of schema registry.
Yep.
I think very clear. And I learned a couple things, which is a bonus.
That's great. That's good.
But nominally, we're here to talk about this being in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And I think, like I said earlier, starting this off, on the one hand, that's kind of a one-sentence announcement, right? You could say, okay, well, Confluent Schema Registry is now available in Confluent Cloud. And if you know what Schema Registry is, you know what that means. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, there's still a little bit more to the story. Like, you know, I can have a Confluent Cloud account and have multiple things called clusters. Yep. Now, because it's in the cloud, cluster is a little bit of a looser concept than, you know, a cluster I deploy on hardware I can see. You know, I don't know how many brokers are in it or anything like that. It's a cloud cluster. It's a logical namespace of topics.
Yep.
And there are brokers certainly in that are in space, you know, and I don't need to know about them because it's a service and, you know, those brokers get managed for me and scaled for me. And it's just a great time to be alive. But because in my Confluent Cloud account, I can have multiple clusters. Well, I think that raises an obvious question. How many schema registries do I have? So do I have to create them? Just kind of walk us through that. There's sort of this data model in cloud. Just walk us through that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So just to give you set some context here, right? Like even in a traditional non-cloud deployment model, the general recommendation we give out to users is like, you must just use one schema registry irrespective of the number of Kafka clusters that you have, because schemas are like organization-wide or at least a business unit-wide metadata. And you should treat that as a centralized thing more than a cluster-specific thing. Obviously, you could sometimes tend to have like collisions with your topic names. So you could namespace your topic names and then avoid those collisions. But the general recommendation is like have one schema registry because it's organization-wide metadata and you want to have one single view of your governance. Schema is a governance thing, in my opinion. So with that in mind, when we started off with the Confluent Cloud thing, we were discussing quite a few options, and then like we thought like there's this logical concept called environments in Confluent Cloud. So environment is just a logical thing; it's a logical grouping of your clusters. An environment could be your dev environment, prod environment, or an environment could be a business unit, or it could be just be a combination of both. So what we thought like was that. For a given environment, you should just have one schema registry. So we kind of thought that was the right thing to do because that's the same recommendation that we give for our on-prem users as well. So that's why when you go into a Confluent Cloud user interface today, which is a web interface, you would typically see the ability to just create one schema registry if you just have one environment. But if you have more than one Kafka cluster, and if you think like there are different environments like dev and prod, you can actually work with our like support team to get them separated as two different environments. And you'll get two different schema registries if you want to treat them as two different environments. So that's on a very high level, like how the schema registry is available across clusters in Confluent Cloud.
It's really one schema registry per environment. And like you said, environment is a logical grouping.
Yep.
Probably dev, staging, prod. I mean, those are that's always how we introduce the concept of environments. Mm-hmm. And most people use them that way. And key underlying point there, like you said, is that schemas are a thing to be shared. Mm-hmm. You would never, well, I don't want to say never, but we would strongly recommend against a schema registry per cluster.
Yep.
It's in, you know, if you're building an event-driven system, mm-hmm. You don't really have APIs and service discovery in the way that you do with an RPC integrated system, you know, classical REST integrated microservices or the bad old days of SOAP or whatever, you know, we have various service discovery mechanisms there. Well, the API now is the format of the stuff in your topic. So yep. Schema is API.
Yep.
And as a result of that, you want the smallest number of schema registries available as you can possibly get away with.
Yep.
That's our opinion as, and you know, we're, I say us as Confluent, we're a group of people who have a certain amount of experience building systems like this and
yep.
have developed opinions that we think are darn good opinions. And we recommend you have them too,
yep.
which is why in Confluent Cloud, it's one per environment. So you can have lots of clusters in an environment and they're all going to be able to share schemas. And that's really, really powerful.
And if you think that absolutely doesn't work for you and there are different business units where you want to separate the clusters and the schemas, you can treat environments as business units.
Of course. Environment doesn't have to be dev prod. I mean, you can make lots of environments and name them whatever you want. So, you know, you can have business unit one dev, business unit two dev, business unit
Absolutely.
One prod, that sort of thing. So, you can separate them out how you want, but it is a hard limitation of the data model that you get one per environment. And that's kind of embodying a strong architectural recommendation of ours.
Yes. But that's also another thing, right? Even though like it's one schema registry per environment, there's no restriction in terms of who uses that schema registry instance. If you have, like, let's say, an on-prem Kafka cluster and producers in your on-premise, they could still talk to the schema registry. There's nothing preventing you from doing that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they still have access to it.
Yep.
External. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Now we don't, this is, we try to make this a podcast of interest to developers. And so, you know, pricing of enterprise software and things like that is not really a thing that we talk about. But you were involved as a lead developer on this stuff. You were involved in discussions of the kind of the economics of schema registry and, you know, internally in a company like us, there's going to be teams that are trying to figure out how do we price this and what do we charge for it? And that's kind of a science in itself that is really interesting on the business side. But where did all that end up? What does schema registry cost me if I'm using Confluent Cloud?
It costs you nothing.
Isn't that great? What a great answer. So, and I know, you know, ladies and gentlemen, of course, the sausage making process behind that answer is complicated. You know, you're rolling out a new product. It's actually hard to figure that out. How do you, you know, present something that's valuable and capture enough of the value that the business is sustainable and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it's free. Schema registry is just there. And it's a feature of Confluent Cloud.
And we think that schema registry is an integral part of event streaming architecture. And like we want all of our users in Confluent Cloud to be using it. That's one of the good practices. And schema registry itself is a very lightweight service. So we went through the economics, we did quite a bit of analysis, we figured out the best deployment model. And eventually, like we thought, like we figured out a way to give it out for free.
Awesome. Yeah. And it that's also that reflects an architectural opinion that we hold also, which is that you really should be using this. And we just want people's clusters in Confluent Cloud to be more valuable to them. And sort of subsidizing schema management is one way of making the whole thing more pleasant because you don't have to, I mean, you still have a cost in that you have to learn how it works and you have to kind of learn the APIs and Avro, EVSC files if you've never done it before. You know, there are startup costs for you to use it, but there are no direct operational costs. We just want to make it so that people use this because it's the right way to use Kafka.
Yep, so absolutely.
Cool. What else, without, you know, obviously talking about any future product plans or anything, what else are you excited about just in the future of Kafka, future of things in the cloud? What's on your mind there?
I'm really looking forward to like supporting multiple data types, like I mentioned earlier. Like we want to be able to support JSON protobuf. That's one exciting thing that I'm looking forward for. And at some time in the future, actually, like it would also be great if we can have some kind of enforcement of the schema on the broker side. Today, all that we do today is the producers and the consumers talk to the schema registry, and there's no real enforcement of the data that's available in the topic. So we want to do some kind of broker side enforcement. That's been requested by a lot of users, actually. So I'm looking forward to that. And then obviously, being in the Connect team, I'm also looking forward to a lot of connectors being available in cloud. I'm actually working on these, and we will look forward to some news there.
There is going to be a lot of Connect news there. Maybe we can have you back on the show to talk about that when
things ship. I'll be glad to do that.
Excellent. Well, my guest today has been Magesh Nandakumar. Magesh, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thanks, Tim. I think it was a great pleasure talking to you and sharing insights about Schema Registry and letting our great developers know about what they think the right Kafka architecture to use for Kafka should be.
And there you have it. I hope that was helpful to you. If you've got questions, you can ask me at TLBerglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on any of our YouTube videos. Your question might be featured on the next episode of Streaming Audio. And feel free to subscribe to our YouTube channel and this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast and just generally helps us get the word out. We appreciate your support. See you next time.